wgtd.org. 8:10 in sports, the St. Louis Cardinals erupted in the 11th inning last night with 5 runs to beat the Brewers 6-1. The White Sox over the Twins 9-3. The Indians beat the Cubs 3-2. In the NBA, the Bucks topped the Magic 114-102 to keep up their chase of the number 2 seed in the Eastern Conference. Brooklyn defeated Chicago 115-107. Now the forecast from the National Weather Service. Sunny today, highs ranging from 58 near Lake Michigan to 63 inland. Another chilly evening, clear and cold, a low around 38. Right now, sunny and 50. I'm David Cole, WGTD News. The morning show is next.
Welcome you to the Wednesday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. For part one of today's program, we're going to be talking about something that actually I am involved in at Carthage during the month of May. It is a collaboration between Carthage's Opera Workshop and something known as the Kenosha Opera Festival, which has some exciting plans for the summer, which we're going to be talking about in just a moment. But we're going to first speak with Allison Hull, who is on the voice faculty at Carthage and who is the stage director for the two performances that are coming up. One this Friday, which will involve a virtual presentation to some public school students in Waterford, and then a public concert in Seabrook Chapel on Sunday afternoon at 3 o'clock. And Allison is the stage director, a traffic cop, and So we're going to start with Allison before she has to run off to teach a voice lesson. So Allison, just tell us, our listeners, about how you first got pulled into this operatic project.
Well, that would be by yourself and Corrine Ness. And I sort of heard about it kind of at towards the end of this term. And you had this wonderful idea of opera, being able to express emotions. And even though things are in a foreign language and we might not be able to understand the text, we can understand the feeling, we can understand the expression and the emotion. And we, the three of us sat around and tried to figure out a way to make that really accessible to kids. And I had just received about 3 or 4 texts from my 4-year-old niece, and they were half emojis. So that was the idea that I kind of came up with, that, well, you know, if we're going to relate this to kids and something that they see every day, use every day, and understand completely, why not emojis?
You have significant experience as does Nick, and I think our other two pro singers as well, but you have a considerable experience when it comes to doing presentations for elementary school kids. You've done quite a lot of that, and we're talking about bringing opera into elementary music rooms. Just say a word about what you've been thinking about in terms of your own experience, what makes sense in terms of making this as effective as it can possibly be for this particular kind of audience.
It's really important to have clear ideas, fun ideas, a variety of ideas, and to not be afraid to be really silly. So sort of all of those factors kind of keep the kids' attention, and to try to get them to see opera not as some sort of grandiose, statuesque kind of art form that no one really likes, but something that they can really relate to and think is really fun. It has a lot of diversity to it, rather than just being sort of this loud singing that people do an imitation of.
Before we let you go, I want you to say a word about the curious mix of participants in this performance, namely 3 professional singers and 3 Carthage students who maybe hope someday to be professional singers themselves. Just say a word about from your perspective as stage director, what it's been like to mix three and three together for this collaboration. Oh,
they've made it pretty easy, actually, and it's a wonderful experience for our three up and coming students who are playing the three ladies in Magic Flute and doing various things in the first part of the opera, to get to work with people who are at the next level. And when I was a young artist back in the day, I always found that I grew towards the group that I was working with. So that if they're thrown into this mix with these three excellent emerging professionals, they're gonna rise to this new expectation that's very different from sort of being able to spend a whole term doing opera workshop. We've had 2 weeks to throw a show together and they're doing it. And that's no easy feat. So I'm really proud of them, and they're really growing, getting to this experience. And hopefully our three professionals are getting a bit of a mentor experience themselves.
Very good. So I want to mention by name that the three Carthage students that are participating in this production are Sarah Jenkins and Morgan Taylor, who both just graduated from Carthage, and London Roysden, who will graduate a year from now. So they are the three Carthage students participating in this production. And Allison Hull, again, the stage director, thanks for taking a couple of minutes. We'll let you get off.
Thank you.
So we have our three professional singers with us now to talk a little further about what this project has been like. Nick Huff, who is the founder and the president of the Kenosha Opera Festival, which is about to launch really its first actual season of live performances for audiences, and talking about that in just a little bit, but collaborating with Carthage Workshop. With him is soprano Keely Futterer and baritone Steve Hobie. And Nick and Steve are both Carthage alums. So glad you can all be part of this. So Nick, talk about your introduction to this project. From whom did this invitation come for you and some of your cohorts to be part of this undertaking?
Sure. So a little while back, Corinne Ness had sent us an email over at the festival and asked if we might be interested in doing some kind of collaboration like this. She had a great, harebrained idea for a neat collaboration we might do, and wanted to put in for a grant. And she wanted to know, would we be interested? And we said, yeah, of course we'd be interested. There's also another Carthage connection or two at the festival besides myself. And we all feel very fondly, and we wanted to join up. So we said, yeah, of course, let's do it. And we didn't hear much for a little while after that, but not too terribly long later, Kareen got back in touch and said, hey, we got the grant. The Racine Community Foundation has awarded us this wonderful grant, and we have funds and facilities and time, and we just need to get together and figure out what we'll do. So then that's when we started, the ball started rolling. You all started having creative meetings. You, of course, the music director, and Allison Hull, who just left, the stage director, coming up with a concept, and the communication between us and the school started to flow. So it was really cool. It was kind of one of those things that just sort of fell in our lap, and we were very, very excited that it did.
So for the sake of everybody listening, none of whom are going to get to see what we're doing on Friday, I mean, anybody listening can come to Carthage on Sunday and see our concert. But on Friday, that will be, of course, this virtual outreach performance to this school in Waterford. Explain what you have put together for these school children in Waterford. What are they going to see on their smart boards Friday afternoon?
Sure. So they're going to see, as we've heard a little bit about already, a fairly familiar sight. They're going to see a number of emojis come across the screen, but not in a way that they maybe have seen before. What they'll see this time, instead of just texts to their family and things with all these fun little faces in their text streams, instead of that, they'll have an opera program, and we'll walk our way through a series of excerpts. We start with a short series of excerpts that just sort of establish what we're doing. And really that's to match the emotional content of an aria or an ensemble with an emoji, which can represent it and something that kids can latch onto and understand really, really quickly. So we have one for happy, say, cheerful. We have one for scary, and it's a scary aria with a witch. And we sort of bang through a series of these quickly just so that the kids sort of understand what's going on. And then we really kind of show up with some more of the goods. They'll hear slightly longer excerpts of all these famous arias from a very wide range of different kind of operas. And what's great about that is, and one thing that I'm really proud about, and as we picked this repertoire out, was that we're not just playing to the lowest common denominator and being completely, it's not a cartoon show where it's, you know, slapstick Bugs Bunny the entire time. We have, for instance, Rusalka's aria, Song to the Moon. There's a lot of emotional content in here of a very wide variety. Even though the whole thing is very energetic and a lot of fun for the kids, which I think they're going to love, they're going to get exposed to a really wide variety of thoughts and feelings and get to identify and access those during the program. So I think it's really great for the kids. And not only is it great for them to sort of be in touch with all of the different things that a person may feel, but also they can see what a variety there is in opera. And so these emojis will sort of cross the stage a number of times and match what's going on. I think it's going to be a lot of fun. The kids are going to love that.
I mentioned that Allison Hull has done a fair amount of performing for school children, performing opera for school children. And I know that you've had considerable experience with that as well. And I suspect Keely and Steve as well have had a lot of experience. Nick, explain the gig you had with the Milwaukee Florentine and the kind of experience that you got in terms of singing for what probably amounts to the world's toughest audience.
Yeah, so I was a member of the studio at the Florentine Opera a few years back by now. Gosh, doesn't feel that long ago, but it was, I guess, a few years ago. And besides having small roles in the main stage operas in their season and concertizing and all that sort of thing, one thing that the studio artists do is sing a children's opera. For us, it was The Three Little Pigs. It was a mashup of a bunch of different scenes from Mozart operas with new English texts that became the story of The Three Little Pigs. And so I think I was the straw house pig, and we had the stick house and the brick house pig, and of course the big bad wolf. And we saw thousands and thousands of kids in the greater Milwaukee, southeastern Wisconsin area. I think we ended up doing between 75 and 100 performances, all of them for an audience of, you know, a whole school or a whole grade level or something like that. And so that is a program that does this a lot and sees a lot of kids. And what's great about that, and part of what's so important about doing this kind of work and why somebody like the Racine Community Foundation might be interested in supporting this sort of thing, or the Milwaukee Florentine, is that you have to bring this stuff to kids. So often, now you're fighting for market share when all of people's preferred entertainment is right there on their TV at home. Even movie theaters suffer from poor attendance these days. And so what you have to do is go out to where people are, and especially kids who may have no other opportunity to access really fine art like opera. Or, you know, often ballet companies will do this sort of thing, or symphonies, and get those kids exposed to what really cool classical art there is. And we put on a children's opera so that they can access it right away. There's no barriers to entry there. Anybody can see what's going on and enjoy it. And it's designed for kids. And hopefully they enjoy it enough that as they grow up, they become fans and patrons of the opera. And they come out and see opera their whole life. We hope. We cross our fingers for that.
Right. So this is actually really quite a different venture then from that. I mean, some of the principles are the same, but what's been put together for this performance is not a children's story right from the get-go.
Yeah, that's true. This is, in a way, one of my favorite. I've done a fair number of, or seen a fair number of, children's titles over the years, and I actually think this one is especially good for the specific purpose that we're not necessarily pulling apart Mozart, say, to do a new story. We are just presenting these kids opera kind of as it is. Even some of the excerpts, some of the longer excerpts, are in the language that they were originally written in. So kids may hear Italian or French or English, and they're going to be exposed in a way that's really pure to what opera truly is. And that's kind of cool too. And it's not to throw shade on anybody else's product, but this is kind of neat in its own way, that they get to see what it really is right up close. And, you know, this time it's on Zoom, but there's no reason why in the future it couldn't be live and in person, or who knows? You know, they say there's going to be a new normal. Maybe it will be Zoom and in person, alternating. Who knows?
Keely, I'm curious to know what experience you have with performing for children. Have you had any gigs in your professional career that have involved this kind of thing before this?
I have, yeah. I actually taught 6th through 9th grade in Arkansas, where I'm from. So I had to perform every single stinking day for those kids. No, it was fantastic. And actually, I was told, I a couple times would perform for the kids and just sing opera. And it was always really sweet because their reactions were, here I am, just their teacher, singing for them to kind of expose them to like what the world has to offer. And it just blew their minds. I remember one time I was singing an aria from, I think, Turandot, and it's a very sad aria. And one of the little girls, 7th grade girl, started crying. She was like, "Miss Futterer, that's so sad. I didn't know what you were saying, but it was really, really sad." So it's amazing. I mean, these kids who had no exposure, they're so brilliant and they're such sponges and they're so emotionally aware. In a way, they're a better audience than adults because they are so open and they're the hardest audience, but they just love it so instantly if they do love it. Mm. And then I also did a kind of concert series with Opera Saratoga where we went around to retirement homes and special living spaces. And that was a whole different kind of outreach that is equally as important and sometimes gets ignored. And these were the audiences of people, you know, living in retirement spaces, and they just adored it because we were coming to them. Like Nick said, they maybe didn't have the access to get to a theater, but we came and we performed for them. And I mean, every single one of those I left, they were crying, I was crying. It was this really beautiful thing because music can be such a connective tissue from person to person, and especially live singing. It's such a visceral experience for all ages. So I've been really lucky to have some unique outreach experiences, but very important.
Good. How about you, Steve Hobie? As we have been rehearsing, you seem like quite a natural in terms of getting into this mode of singing with kind of a special energy that connects to kids. Have you done very much of this?
So most of my experience, my original degree is in music theater, so I like to play as it is, but graduated from Carthage, I started teaching kindergarten. So I've had a lot of fun. Just in kindergarten in particular, you can't stop. There is no stop. It's all play. And that's what we're learning. We're learning how to interact with each other in a kindergarten kind of space. We're learning how to school, so to say. And so to have the opportunity to just play almost all the time in that kind of space and translate that into an art space is just fantastic. And for me, I also work quite often in the sciences and in education in the sciences. That's where most of my day work comes from. So I have that easy crossover where I do my best to make both science and the arts accessible in other ways, because really they are parts of our world that are just sometimes intangible to some folks. So to create that tangible connection is a necessity to make it more exciting, to make it real, to make it part of their world. And so that's really what I'm here for. I love to facilitate discovery. That's my whole spiel when I'm looking, whether it's to perform on the stage in this kind of setting for kids or to perform in a planetarium. Like, for me, it's going to be the same approach, just a different audience.
Let me jump in there too to say, when we were trying to decide which pros we wanted to bring, Steve and I had worked together since school, after school, in the summer program at the Florentine Opera together. And I knew when I was hearing him that summer do Largo al Factotum, which is the famous Figaro, Figaro, Figaro aria from the Barber of Seville. I was like, this guy is perfect for children's opera. So we started talking about doing this project, and I was like, well, Steve Hobie has to come and do it. So I called him like right away.
Remember when we were in Green Bay and I sang Largo at the Botanical Garden? I thought that, so it was the opening of the Botanical Garden, essentially the second performance. And I thought that it was a perfect circle around the stage. I was going to ham up Largo. I was going to make like I had just woken up and then run across the stage, run around and appear on the other side. Well, it turns out there's a creek that flows next to the stage. So I end up running for about a minute and a half, trying to get around this entire stage to get on stage. I end up just crawling up the front of the stage and start singing Largo with no breath at all, out of breath and just dying. And at one point, I made it through most of the aria, and then I just was exasperated and had to take like a measured pause. And everyone started laughing.
So there's no always... creeps in this production.
Very good. For those of you just joining us, we are talking today in this portion of the morning show right now with three singers who are participating in a really exciting project. First, an outreach to school children this coming Friday called Emoji Goes to the Opera. And then on Sunday afternoon at 3 o'clock at Carthage's Sieber Chapel, a concert called Opera Round K-Town, part of Carthage's Performing Arts Series, which will feature these three professional singers plus three students from Carthage who are part of Carthage's Opera Workshop. And Steve and Nick are both alums of Carthage, so there is this strong Carthage connection. And again, this concert on Sunday afternoon, kind of an expanded version of the program we've been describing, is open to the public for people to actually come to Sieber Chapel, sit in the audience, and experience this singing in person. I think it would be interesting to hear from each of you a little bit about how you first became enamored, first of all, with singing, I mean serious singing, and then specifically with the world of opera. And Nick, I know a little bit of your story about that since I was your voice teacher here at Carthage, but I know your interest in singing actually predates any study you did with me. When did all of this start for you?
Well, it's kind of a funny story, actually. I don't know if you, I thought you knew this story, but I know we're telling it for the benefit of the listeners, but you may not, actually. When I was fairly young, you know, I was homeschooled. My mom homeschooled us. And she felt that it was a really vital part of the schooling to do arts education. So we all had to learn to paint and learn to sketch and learn to do music. And I was taking piano lessons, and me and my teacher just did not have good chemistry. You don't always luck out and get Greg Bird for a teacher. So I said to my mom, I'm quitting. I won't do it. And she said, well, you have to do it. You have to do it. And we're kind of at an impasse, both very stubborn type personalities. And the compromise was to take voice lessons. And so I took voice lessons from a fairly young age. I think it was 12 when I started. And I sort of, you know, I had one teacher or another up until the time that I came to you. And that was my senior year of high school. I still didn't know that I actually wanted to do music professionally. I liked a lot of other things, visual arts. I used to work drawing caricatures at a theme park at Six Flags. You know, I like a lot of things. I have a lot of interests. And so it took me a long time to decide what I actually wanted to do with my life. And it wasn't actually until I was already in college. I enjoyed my time with you and I got a scholarship. So I majored in music, but it was really the opera workshop my freshman year that we did. We sang The Marriage of Figaro and I sang Don Basilio. And I was enjoying it so much. I didn't even realize how much I was enjoying it until it was over. And I was like, there's something missing from my life. And you know, emotionally unaware person that I can sometimes be, I was just kind of down. And somebody said, well, have you sung lately? And I said, no, actually, I haven't. We finished. And I've just kind of been like playing video games and sketching. And they said, well, go sing. And I did. And I felt better. And I realized that that was something that was giving me so much fulfillment. And that was kind of the light bulb moment that I wanted to be a performer professionally. And I wanted to really shoot for that. Hard career though it is, any of these guys here can tell you, but and you know, of course, but you know, it's so fulfilling and so beautiful and so powerful that I kind of had to go with it.
Right. And we should mention that Nick, after graduating from Carthage, went on to study opera further at Eastman, which is of course one of the finest music schools in the world, and it's there that he met Keeley. And so the song goes on. Keeley, how did opera enter your life down in Arkansas where you grew up?
I had the misfortune of being the daughter of two instrumentalists, actually. And so I have grown up with music. Probably my mom always says that I sang before I talked. And I don't know if that's real or not, but we'll just say it is because I don't want to fight with my mom. And she played actually in the orchestra pit for opera Wildwood. And so I can remember literally being 3 or 4 years old, going down to Little Rock with her and sitting in the pit orchestra with her in rehearsals and hearing all these crazy people sing up on stage and just being absolutely overwhelmed, even as a little kid, like, holy cow, this is incredible. This is coming out of people's mouths. No way. This is great. And the music was interesting and emotional. And then my dad also has conducted music theater. And so we were all involved in summer musicals. And I would like to say that I didn't have a chance, but my parents tried very hard. They pushed us into anything else other than music. They knew it was a difficult career. But I was hooked from basically birth, and there was no other way for me. I just love it. It's my heart and soul.
Well, when you sing, we really get that sense. Absolutely.
Oh, Steve, that's very sweet.
I know that you were busy singing in high school, but I know you were also busy playing football in high school. You were a young man juggling a lot of different things. How did you make sense of all that back then?
So I did a lot of crazy things in high school. I was mostly hockey was my big deal, and football and powerlifting. And then those were my three sports, and they wouldn't let me do marching band. I'm thankful that they said that marching band was a sport, but also that meant that I couldn't do it. So I was an instrumentalist first. I played bass clarinet through sixth, seventh grade and such. And then my English teacher, who was also a bass clarinetist, said, "You should go on stage and do a show." So I thought, why not? I'll do a show, and ended up saying a lot of watermelon and strawberries, but you know, we made it through. And I kind of got that hook for being on stage as a kid in sixth to eighth grade and such. And I started doing it in high school, among all the other things. I would do, like I still do today, I did a lot of stage crew and lighting and the fly systems and such. And my first show, I did my first musical my freshman year and realized, oh, I can't hold a pitch. I'm tone deaf. This is awful. And so my friend Allison had me join a choir, and I started to hold my own. The first time I was really exposed to opera was we had a new choir director come in, and he took everyone to Lohengrin at Lyric Opera Chicago. I didn't go, but they made all this big deal about it. And I ended up trying to mimic opera as a big bass voice. And then I was just trying honestly to make fun of opera at that point. And our choir director was like, "That's not bad. That's pretty good." And so apparently it was in me somewhere, but I ended up going to find I wanted to find a place where I could have fun doing musical theater for school. And also and I had this kind of lifelong passion on dinosaurs and paleontology and fossils and stuff. So I was able to do both of those here, and I still can do both today, which is pretty fantastic.
Right. So you are juggling a couple of different passions and juggling them very, very well. And we're glad in your busy schedule that you've found time to do this. Nick, I know that one of the things that has been really important for you is the fact that you and Keeley are both really pursuing with kind of singular focus singing careers, are right in the middle of launching careers in the midst of this pandemic. Can you just say a word about what a challenge this has been for you, and for that matter, for all of your counterparts all over the country, all over the world, in terms of trying to remain viable as artists and sort of keeping things moving at a time when so much has ground to a halt.
Yeah, sure. It's tough to even really say at first, just because, you know, for us, things are, it looks like here in the States, finally, maybe, I don't want to jump the gun, but might be opening up a bit by bit in the next 6 or 9 months, and we'll see what happens. But at least the outlook's positive, finally. You know, currently in Europe, there are new lockdowns. All my friends that work in Germany and other places around Poland, around Europe, are freshly out of work. And so it's tough to see that for them. But it's an experience that we've all had over the course of this pandemic. I'll tell you, it's so frustrating because in my case, at least, I was starting to really pick up steam. I was down in Miami when this started. I was singing with the Florida Grand Opera in their studio. And I had just finished singing Don Ottavio from Don Giovanni by Mozart. That was a wonderful experience. We were getting ready to do Rigoletto, in which I had one of the smaller tenor roles. And, you know, over the course of maybe a week or two, everything just evaporated. 1 week we're rehearsing, preparing this opera, singing this wonderful music with guest artists from all over the place who are wonderful. And then the next week, I actually remember because I was going to have a St. Patrick's Day party and it didn't happen because, you know, of course, in March of that of last year, things kind of started to disintegrate. And 1 week we were rehearsing, the next we were told the mayor of Miami said, you know, if you're from here, hunker down, get some groceries. If you're not from here, get out. And so we were on the road, and we didn't expect to be on the road. And we were, Keely and I were thinking, well, where should we go right away? What's going to happen? Because, you know, when you are with a company for an extended period like that, they house you. So we were living down in Miami on a temporary basis for the contract. And, you know, Keely's parents are just a little bit older. We didn't know that much about the virus at that point. And so we thought, gosh, if Miami's a hot spot, should we go to there? We ended up coming to Wisconsin and staying with my folks. And we actually stayed separated in the house at first. Anyway, everybody knows all of the precautions that we took, but our industry in particular, which relies pretty much exclusively on gathering people together, basically came to a grinding halt. We could do nothing. And so it was pretty bleak. I'm not gonna sugarcoat it for a while there. But one thing I'll say to spin it positive, and this is really a wonderful and happens to be true thing that happened. These companies and individuals all over the world started looking for ways that they could still communicate art together and start doing projects online, or how do we create something together? And people pretty much right away started to figure out, you know, what would work to get together in person, all of the precautions you'd have to take, what's the overhead for that? And, you know, other people took the other direction, started making fun online content distanced. Actually, that's what we did at the festival. We picked probably the worst year ever in history maybe not ever in history, but certainly in recent events to launch a company. Our company anniversary is January 1st. And so within a few months, all our planning was completely shut down. We ended up putting together a digital program. So I was reaching out to singers and saying, hey, do you have any arias you would record or have on hand? And Steve helped us out, and Keely was in there, and a number of wonderful artists. We had artists from all over the country and world. We had submissions from Vienna and other places, just reaching out to the network and seeing who was interested in trying to make some art together. We stitched together a chorus. Of course, you played piano for that. It was Va Pensiero, a famous Verdi opera chorus. And just doing our best to make it happen. And it was actually really wonderful to see, because in a time that for musicians, but for everybody, was so dark and so awful, there was some kind of way to do something together and make something wonderful and creative and fun and bring a little levity, which is really, you know, what artists do. We bring perspective to people's lives and bring joy and escape and all those wonderful things. And we got to still do that. And even though it's been a tough year for us and everybody, you know, there were little high points, and it's finally looking like maybe we can go back. People are just sort of whispering about scheduling things in the future. So it's looking better and better.
So we want to reiterate that coming up this Sunday afternoon, so that's Sunday the 16th of May, 3:00 in the afternoon at Siebert Chapel, the six singers that we have been talking about and the three singers who are talking with me right now are presenting a concert of opera music that will feature some absolutely stunning arias, and then the entire opening scene of Mozart's The Magic Flute. And people are invited to actually come to Carthage and sit in Siebert Chapel and to take in this concert. Protocols will be observed in terms of physical distancing, but it is absolutely, absolutely fine for people to come to Carthage and take in this concert in person. It's just a matter of reserving your free tickets online and go to carthage.edu, click on the bridge, and you'll find this event, and you can find out information on how to reserve your free ticket so you can be in the audience for Sunday afternoon's concert. In our closing minutes, Nick, I want to give you a chance just to briefly summarize what's going to be happening this summer.
Oh, thanks. I will do my best to be brief. It's a lot, actually, I'll tell you. We already had pretty ambitious plans, but this thing kind of became, the Kenosha Opera Festival, our new company, kind of became several people's COVID project. And so we've taken on an even more ambitious and even more exciting season than we otherwise had planned. So we have something called the Summer Recital Series, which there are a number of events within that brand. Some of them are buttoned up traditional recitals from the professional artists who are going to be visiting Kenosha to sing our main stage opera. Some of them will be fellows in a fellowship program that we are starting. Some of those are Carthaginians, some are from Eastman and other places around. And they'll have a special recital that puts the spotlight on them. There's a brewery concert at Rustic Road Brewery, where it'll have all kind of drinking themed, silly body type, humorous repertoire. And a number of those things are free. Some are ticketed. Besides the summer recital series, we also have a children's opera, family opera, I've been calling it, Birds of a Feather, which is actually written by you. And it's a really, really darling piece where some of the characters from The Magic Flute by Mozart, Papageno and Papagena, are imagined in sort of a sequel fashion. What happens to them after The Magic Flute? They have a whole duet where they talk about, I feel weird saying this to you, you wrote the thing, but they have a whole duet where they talk about all the kids they want to have and what will their kids do and who will they be and what will their activities be, their interests. So they actually, we get a chance to see in this opera, and it's really a lot of fun. They sort of disagree with their kids, and the whole theme is about letting people be who they are and allowing people to just flourish as they are. And it's really a wonderful message for kids and families. We're going to do that July 23rd at the Northside Library there. It'll be outdoors, so if you're still concerned about gathering, that's very well ventilated. Besides that, the big thing for the summer is the main stage opera. We're going to do a semi-staged production of La Fille du Régiment, The Daughter of the Regiment, which is an absolute barn burner of an opera, with all kinds of high-flying vocal acrobatics. It always gets very large rounds of oohs and ahs. But also we're going to be doing it with a wonderful, wonderful director from Australia named Greg Eldridge. And he has decided on a sort of, we worked on together, a Cambridge Review kind of Monty Python style treatment. So it will be very silly and somewhat absurd. And I think it'll get as many ha-has and laughs and big rounds of laughter as it does oohs and ahs. So it should be a lot of fun. This is one of those things that got expanded. It was going to originally just be a concert version with orchestra. That was the big thing we wanted to accomplish, orchestra. But Greg reached out and he was interested in working with us. And we love him and his work. And so we're going to do sort of a semi-stage thing. So it should be very, very fun, and I think audiences are going to love it. There's a lot. You can find all of our events on our website at KenoshaOperaFestival.com, and you can peruse for yourself and get tickets for things that are ticketed or find directions for things that aren't.
Excellent. Fantastic. In the meantime, we want to remind people again about the concert that is coming up this Sunday afternoon, May 16th at 3 o'clock in the afternoon at Siebert Chapel. It will be a concert that features some of the most famous and beloved of all opera arias, plus the opening scene to Mozart's The Magic Flute. And part of Sunday afternoon's concert will, in a sense, kind of recreate or echo the lively presentation that's going to be done for some elementary students on Friday, but expanded and and reshaped a bit to make it really appropriate and enjoyable for a mature audience. And that is absolutely free, open to the public, and you are welcome to come to Carthage and to come to Siebert to enjoy this concert. But you should go to the Carthage website in order to secure a free ticket and reserve your space. And again, protocols will be observed for physical distancing to keep everybody, including audience members and our singers, absolutely safe. I want to thank our three professional singers who are part of this undertaking, this really exciting project, Nick Huff and Keely Futterer and Steve Hobie. Great to have you as part of this and great to have you as part of the morning show. Thank you so much and best wishes to all of you.
Thank you.
Thanks, Greg.
Thanks, Greg. Thanks for having us.
And here is a brief snippet from just one of the pieces that's going to be featured on Sunday afternoon's opera concert at Carthage's Siebert Chapel. Here is tenor Nick Huff in the beginning of the sparkling aria A Mes Amis from Donizetti's La Fille de Régiment, The Daughter of the Regiment.
A mes amis, jour de fête, je vais manger sous votre drapeau. A mes amis, jour de fête, je vais manger sous votre drapeau. L'amour qui m'a tourné la tête, désormais me rend en l'air. À quel bonheur, et mes amis, je vais marcher sous mon drapeau, je vais marcher sous mon drapeau. Oui, celle pour qui je respire, à mes voeux, à mes amis, quel jour de fête, je vais marcher sous votre drapeau, je vais marcher sous votre drapeau, je vais marcher. À mes amis, je vais marcher sous votre drapeau.
And to finish out today's morning show here on WGTD, we're going to be talking about a very exciting new resource for young readers. Write Brain, and that's W-R-I-T-E, Write Brain, is the creation of a professional actress named Meredith Scott Lynn. The central concept is that a youngster is presented with what amounts to a colorful children's book replete with spectacular illustrations, but where the words would typically appear on the page, there are instead empty lines, and it is left to the youngster to choose words with which to create the story itself. It's one more way, and a very intriguing way, to help youngsters break out of the common pattern of passive consumption of entertainment from a screen hours on end, something that can keep youngsters from creating something meaningful themselves.
The videos that are on their phone, the games, the moving images are so comforting. Mm. You know, they don't have to go, they don't have to give anything of themselves. They have to just take it in, take in, take in. And we have to create opportunities for young people. And like I said, of all ages, we're in high schools all over the place, shockingly, but not to me, with this children's book authoring program in it. It brings out the grown-up in young people when you say to them, hey, you're 7, write a book for a child even younger than you are. Hey, you're 17, what is the wisdom, what's the joy you would want to impart, right, on a 5-year-old child who's going to be hearing your book aloud when you go to the public library and read your book to kids in the community.
Hmm.
And the ownership when they receive it, because there's a digital component. And by the way, any of your listeners can go online right now to writebrainbooks.com, W-R-I-T-E. Go online. They can go to the book builder. All they do is put in their email. We don't spam. We don't send you follow-up. I haven't quite figured that out yet. They can choose a book. They could see all of the images. The book opens up beautifully on the screen. They could write on paper first. They could type into the screen. And then all they have to do is put their picture. They write a full story. They put their photo and bio in the back. And with a credit card, you can order a gorgeous hardcover book with a shiny dust jacket. It comes straight to your door. It's insane. Isn't that beautiful?
Yeah.
Can you imagine a book, Greg, sitting on the shelf of an 8-year-old's bedroom? It's a full-on children's book. Every word on every page is his title's on the front, his author's name's on the front, his photo's in the back. It's a book. It doesn't live in a cloud. It's something he can hold and show his own children 30 years from now.
Incredible.
You know, isn't that amazing?
By the way,
it inspires me every day.
What age group, by the way, are we talking about? Do you envision this for particular ages of children?
You know, I have to be honest. If you can't write at all, and we have a whole pre-K package, as long as you can talk, like my niece wrote her first book when she was 3, my niece Ivy. So did Lila. I have a little video of Lila going, I am a right brain author. She was 3 because she could talk. So we would sit together, or my mom, her grandma, or her mom, my sister, would sit with her. She would look at the pictures and tell us what to write. And we would write what she said. And sometimes we would say to help her, you know, early literacy, close looking at images. It doesn't matter as long as they can talk. And by the way, showing 2-year-olds, 1-year-olds, colorful images, pointing to things and making identifications for them, that is early literacy, right? Not on a pad, but on paper or in a book. So she would sit and tell me what she was seeing. And I would say, oh, that's good. So, but how do you think the bear is feeling? She'd say, happy. And I'd say, what's another word for happy? And she would look at me and I'd say, how about ecstatic or joyful? And she'd go, ecstatic. Now, she's 3. She doesn't know what ecstatic means, but she said it like she knew it. And, you know, later in life, she's going to have this book. So we would encourage colors and sounds and, you know, what color is the ball? Pink. And help the story become more descriptive. But it all came from her. So then now, here she is. She's 8. And she's got a library. I mean, she has a huge shelf stacked with right brain books that she has written over her lifetime. And she goes into school with all of her books to do a show and tell. She's a published author, because every child who writes a right brain book, if they go onto the website to type in their story, whether through a classroom or at home, they get a published copy. So even though it's not through the Library of Congress, we have a kid here in California. His mother bought 50 copies. He got a booth at the farmer's market, and he sat and he signed his books and he sold them. We couldn't be happier.
Meredith Scott Lynn is the creator of Right Brain Books. And again, Right is spelled W-R-I-T-E. And much more information is available at their website, www.rightbrainbooks.com. Tomorrow on The Morning Show, it's Nan Calvert with her monthly visit to the program, and with her will be Samantha Catt, who is a stormwater specialist with Wisconsin's DNR, the Department of Natural Resources. And on Friday, I'm scheduled to speak with Ben Golliver, a reporter for The Washington Post and author of a very interesting new book called Bubble Ball. which examines the challenge which the NBA, the National Basketball Association, faced in trying to preserve their most recent season within the encroaching restrictions of the COVID-19 pandemic, including the challenge of trying to keep their players within safe bubbles where they would not contract the virus. A really, really interesting story explored